The European Union has made it a lot easier in recent years for residents to relocate and reinvent themselves in another EU member country. Whatever reasons you might have for moving away from where you were born, if you're a European resident, you have lots of choices for changing what kind of scene you want to live in. Joining us now on Travel with Rick Steves with their own stories of making a new life outside their home countries are Tricia Brady and Susanna Perichini. Tricia originally comes from Scotland, and she now lives in a restored farmhouse she bought in the rural La Marche region of Italy. Susanna was raised in northeast Italy. She lived in Rome for a while, and a few years ago, she relocated to Madrid in Spain. Susanna and Tricia, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to be here.
You're both Europeans, and I've noticed this trend. Europeans, it's almost unlikely these days to find a European who's living where they were raised. In the old days, that was a big thing. You stayed in your community. How has the European Union made it easier for Europeans to be raised in one country and eventually settle in another? Tricia?
Well, you have a choice, which is nice. So I work in Italy. I work for an American company, and I'm paid in Britain. So I can choose where I pay my taxes. And so I choose to get away from the bureaucracy of Italy, and I pay my taxes in Britain.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're enjoying the best of both worlds. You're living in Italy, but trying to avoid the bureaucracy of Italy. So you're a taxpayer
yes.
in Britain.
Yeah.
Susanna, how about you? How has the European Union enabled you to decide you want to live in Spain instead of Italy?
Well, you know, I think not only for me, I didn't go to university, but many of my friends, they had the possibility to, after or in between finishing the university, to go and spend, let's say, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months abroad in one of the many European countries. And we had this program that I think is still on, which is called Erasmus. You might be familiar with that.
Right.
So it was subsidized by the government, well, actually by the European community. And many of my friends had that experience. It doesn't mean that many of them, all of them, ended up living in that country, whatever it was, but at least they improved the language, or they decided to try again and have more possibilities job-wise.
Or to just simply better understand the other communities in the European Union.
Absolutely.
So the European government, even in tough economic times, continues to fund young people to study in foreign countries. This is this Erasmus program. Why did you decide to change from Italy to Spain?
Well, you know, for me, the weather has always been very important. And everybody knows that we're pretty lucky in Italy because we have nice weather, generally speaking. And several of my good friends, they were living or they lived a chunk of their times in UK or in Scotland, which I love. But, you know, weather-wise, it was terrible. So I've been there several times. And I said, no way. I mean, must be closer to my heart. So I decided to go to Spain.
So you went to Spain. How is Spain better than Italy for you?
I think that it's better because, you know, whatever happens in Spain, they make lots of mistakes. Politicians are not perfect. Bureaucracy is pretty tough, but not as tough as the Italian one.
So you're a refugee from Italian bureaucracy.
Yes, I am.
You know, I was just filming there, and I can understand that. I went into a museum, and before they gave me permission, I went downstairs and had to sign a bunch of papers. They had a three-ring notebook with all of their "We're on strike" posters. And they had like 8 different kinds of strike, but they just had them saved for next time they were going on strike. They were in a 3-ring binder, and they just roll their eyes every time they have to deal with their own bureaucracy. I can understand how that might be a frustration
yes.
in spite of all the beautiful things in Italy. Tricia, you moved from Scotland to Italy. You're moving into the storm. Why did you do that?
Well, I'm half Italian, mm-hmm. and my life just kind of took me that way, and I found a ruin, and I restored it, and I love the quality of life in Italy. It's a different quality of life than I had in England or in Scotland. The bureaucracy is the most frustrating thing living mm-hmm. in Italy, I have to say.
But still, the quality of life
yes.
trumps
and
that
the weather.
You.
And the part of Italy where I live, which is Le Marche, is so sunny. It's like sunny Scotland. It's similar countryside.
Oh, that's nice, yeah.
Beautiful.
When you look at all of this movement in Europe, both of you, do you see any trends from where are people wanting to go, where are people wanting to leave, and why?
At the moment, people are leaving in their droves because of the situation, the crisis financially.
Leaving where?
All of the European, Spain and France and Italy are the three main sort of holiday places for other Europeans to have holiday homes.
Right.
And the market, you just look on the internet, there's so much for sale.
So they went down there because they're these Mediterranean paradises, but now the economy is worse in the Mediterranean and the housing market is depressed because nobody wants to buy these houses.
Well, they have homes perhaps in the north with mortgages,
right,
and they've bought these places often with another mortgage, and suddenly with this situation financially in the world, they're just can't afford.
Is there a movement to the north because of the economic crisis?
That's what I would think. For example, most of the people I know with degrees and even PhDs, they tend to go to UK or to Finland, Sweden, those kind of countries.
Okay, where the economy might be more promising from an employment point of
yes,
view?
Yes, I mean, what do
tough
you do?
Tough to get a job in Spain or
exactly.
Greece.
Exactly, well,
now.
In Spain especially, you know, that we have the right. highest rate in Europe of unemployment.
What kind of bureaucratic headaches are there when you move, say, from Italy to Spain?
Well, I have to say that somehow the European community is something like a very young boy or very young girl. So very new. Everything is new, but things somehow they are improving. So for me, it was very easy because the only thing that I have to do being a European citizen is to say to my country, you know, I'm not living here anymore. And in order to be able to get a resident permit in Spain, you just have to bring your contract. You know, I signed a contract for a flat because I don't own a flat where I live in. And you bring it in the Registro Civil and they give you a paper. And with that paper, you can claim any kind of document.
So governments are happy that people are moving around and it's a healthy thing?
I don't know if they're happy, but they are providing services.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about living as a borderless European, and we're joined by Susanna Perrocchini, an Italian who's decided to live in Madrid, and Tricia Brady, who's a Scottish woman who's decided to live in Italy. Susanna, when you think of Europe and how Europe is dealing with the challenges confronting it, because you've both lived in different countries and you've got a lot of friends that are quite international, is it a feeling of all for one and one for all, or is it every country for themselves and let's just somehow manage on our own and to heck with the rest of them?
Well, you know, being on your own is exactly the opposite idea that the European community has. So it would be, for me, going backward instead of going forward. So I, despite everything, despite the crisis, despite everything else, I truly believe this is a good idea. So many people, they're starting to say to me, oh, it would be nice to cut off those poor countries.
Right.
You know, let's face it, Italy is not a poor country, but somehow we're doing so badly. And Spain just joined the European community in 1986. They were doing so well. And all of a sudden, boom, they went into the pit. So I truly believe that we have to hang on it because it's good, because our sons can have benefits, more benefits than bad things from the European community, but we have to be patient and hold on to it. We really need to believe that Europe was not a failure.
I'd like to close just with this whole sort of psychological who am I idea about living in Europe. Tricia, you're Scottish, you're Italian, you're living with a bunch of Italian rural communities, small town Italian people and so on. What is your and what are your neighbors' outlooks? Are you people from the Marche? Are you Italians? Are you Europeans? How do you identify yourself when you're moving all over the place like this?
I've always felt like a European. I'm not for Scottish nationalism. I've got this Scottish accent, deep accent, but I have never, ever been for it.
And when you go into the market and you're waiting in line for the produce with people who live on farms around you who have never been out of Italy, how do they see themselves?
I think they don't actually see themselves any particular way because they haven't travelled, so they don't have that perspective.
So they would be a little more regional.
Yes, and they laugh. You know, when I say I'm off to Naples tomorrow, they burst out laughing and say, Naples tomorrow? Very nice, you know.
They probably haven't been
something.
There once
in
a lifetime.
They haven't been to the local village.
Susanna, how do you see yourself?
Well, you know, Rick, it's important to keep in mind that no matter how far I will go, and that's something that I started to think about it many years ago, no matter how many years I can spend in a country, can be Spain, can be Finland, I will always be Italian. And it's something that it's the core of you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you. I mean, you grew up in this little town, Edmonds. You can be all over, but you will be the old Rick, the same person. So I'm just growing as a person. I'm trying to embrace more things, but I will be Italian till I die, if I like it or not. So I become more Italian every time that I spend more time in any foreign country. But at the same time, I embrace things from other countries. I love ham, jamón. I can cook croquetas, but I'm still and always be Italian.
Very interesting. Susanna Perrucchini, Tricia Brady, what a wonderful time of opportunity you live in to be in Europe, to be able to be free to call home any country you like and to still be whatever you like, Scottish, European, Italian, Spanish. Thanks a lot and best wishes.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Because I travel so much of the year, I find it really comforting to come home to the town I was raised in. After all these years of globetrotting, I still live right where I grew up, in Edmonds, Washington. It's the place that was sort of the springboard for my 40 years of European travel. Joining me now for a look back on how our travels turned into a career is my original travel buddy from high school, Gene Openshaw. He's been a featured guest on Travel with Rick Steves a few times in the past, and Gene will be joining us on the show from time to time now with some fun features on European art, history, and culture in the months to come. Right now, let's look back on how we started out, vagabonding our way across Europe on a shoestring right out of high school. Okay, let's go back. Let's go back to the year 1973. Richard Nixon was facing Watergate. The world was facing an oil crisis, and two teenage boys from the suburbs of Seattle were heading off to Europe on their first trip, the first time overseas, away from their parents, the first taste of high culture. That was more than 40 years ago, and that was me and Gene Openshaw, our first trip to Europe on our own. I'm joined by Gene Openshaw now. He was my travel partner back in 73, and he's been working with me for the last 40 years. Boy, it makes me feel a little bit old, but we're still young at heart. And Gene's the co-author of several of my guidebooks. Gene, how did a couple of kids like us, with no cultural background, grow up to be talking about art and history now on the radio?
Well, let me take you back to our first trip. I brought something here. Hoping to kind of spark some memories of what travel was like
back then.
Yeah. Few coins from the pre-euro days. Here, look.
Okay, we're talking 73. So back then, we had a Deutschmark, we had a franc, a Greek drachma.
Here's a lira.
And a Norwegian, a Danish crown with a hole in it. I love it.
It was a very different world. Europe back then was quite different than travel today. You just think about some of the most basic things that we take for granted, like phone calls. If you wanted to make a phone call, you had to gather a bunch of coins like this.
Pop them in. You'd get all the coins you could gather, pop them in, and you get to talk 1 minute to your girlfriend or your mom and dad.
Yeah. The world wasn't globalized. Very few people spoke English. And I really had the sense, I don't know about you, that we were kind of on our own out there, sort of the dark side of the moon.
And there's the Cold War, and that was scary. I remember standing in Berlin next to that wall, and it was scary. Crossing borders, just remember, you know, angry dogs and strange people coming at 2 o'clock in the morning to take your passports.
And you did not question them.
No.
Yeah, Europe was kind of, you felt like it was sort of a battlefield, a battleground between these two nuclear superpowers.
But way back then, I still think there was the seeds of globalization. It was like we were on the edge of a new world.
You know, remember this? We're on the Rhine River. We're at that castle in, was it Bacharach? Where you're up on that hill.
Yeah.
Beautiful summer night. We're out there and we're surrounded. It's us. We're a couple of teenagers and we're surrounded by a bunch of other teenagers and their hormones. And we're looking out over the Rhine River. And I did get a sense of globalization because we all had some things in common. We all had gotten Eurail passes.
We all had $3 a night for a bunk at the youth hostel there.
Yeah. Yep.
We're all fascinated by medieval castles and the river cruise up and down the Rhine River.
And fascinated by pop culture. That was about the only thing we had in common.
That's true.
You know, the Beatles, She Loves You, Yeah. Ah, das ist gut.
Right.
You know, or talking about Hollywood movies.
And a Coca-Cola, everybody wanted a Coke. Right.
That's where I thought we really connected with the Europe that was coming of age and would become the globalized world.
Well, this was a time when people were traveling and connecting, and we were first world travelers, so we hung out with other first world travelers. When we did go to Bulgaria, we'd hang out with people from Cuba and Angola and Russia because that was a parallel world. But there in Germany on the Rhine, it was people from Australia, from France, from Canada, from the United States. We learned a lot about culture, even though I remember just going to the museums because my mom said it'd be a crime not to. But stepping into those museums, we did gain an appreciation of high culture.
Mona Lisa, that knocked my socks off.
Stepping into St. Mark's Square in Venice. Oh man. Stepping into the greatest cathedral in Europe, St. Peter's Basilica.
Oh, man. Yeah, the Baroque, the gold leaf, the statues.
You know, we didn't probe too deeply into it, but we did have a respect for what people did centuries ago for their state, for their religion, for their community. There was a lot of passion and a lot of energy put into civilization back then.
And when we came back, we weren't art scholars by any means, nor are we now. But we do at least have a knowledge and understanding of what's out there. But what I think, you know, we learned a lot from the museums and the art. But what really taught me the most, I think, was just the fact that Europe was so different then. It was kind of jarring when we went there. It kind of opened our eyes. You know, we're in Amsterdam and you're seeing these hippies and freaks and smoking pot and the girls on Zeedijk Street and the sex trade. And for a couple of teenage boys, that was kind of a... You're kind of trying to figure it all out.
We were like two little rhesus monkeys huddling together and hugging each other, trying not to get into too much trouble.
See no evil, hear no evil.
But when we flew home, the world was our playground.
Yeah.
Think about all of the... I remember looking back on my journal from that trip, there were so many just mistakes that turned into great experiences. What's one of the mistakes that you remember?
One event that stands out and probably just sums up the whole trip for me. Remember, we tried to save money by not getting a hotel or a hostel, but we tried to sleep free on an empty train car that was parked in a train
that
yard.
That was in Yugoslavia, wasn't it?
Yes.
And this train looked like it hadn't moved for decades. It was just sitting there. I thought moss was growing on its wheels. So we both, you and I, looked at each other like we just struck it rich. You know, hey, we could go into there, slip into there. Nobody's looking. Nobody cares. Pull out all the chairs. That was when the chairs that faced each other pulled out and made a big bed. So you had a double bed. We rolled out our sleeping bag. We didn't even bother with our tube tent.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, we were kings. We were laying there. It felt so good for about like 3 hours.
And what made it feel even better, it was absolutely free.
It was absolutely free. And we were so smart. But then, in the middle of the night, wham! The train jerks to a start, and we jerk wide awake, and we're going, oh,
both of us are looking out the window like, what the heck? And we didn't know where we're going. Yugoslavia was scary enough. Suddenly, we're hurtling through the night on a train that we don't have a ticket for, and we didn't know where the heck we were going. And I remember we felt like a couple of rudely awakened butterflies coming out of their cocoons, and we dragged all of our sleeping bags with us, standing at the door, wondering, should we jump out at this suburban station, or should we stay in the train and go to Bucharest or something? So we decided to leap, and we landed in this little, dark, dingy suburban station outside of Belgrade.
Yep.
And then a man came over with a... We leaped out of the moving train, didn't we?
Yes, and landed just splat right on the concrete platform.
We could have hit a pillar and bounced back onto the train, and there'd be no more trips. But then I remember this. We kind of checked everything. My main concern was, did we get all of our stuff off the train with us? And then were we in one piece? And this man walks over with a lantern. Actually, it was like a lantern. Yeah. And he'd say, who are these two crackpots? And then he took us in like a loving scoutmaster. He gave us a little place to sleep, and we were on our way.
It seemed like the perfect metaphor of a European with a lantern pointing us the way to our future.
Two kids opening up to the rest of the world.
It was a bit of a rude awakening, but it was probably a healthy one for a couple of young kids from the suburbs.
I'm sure thankful for that trip. That was the best trip ever, Gene. And what's great in my mind is that those kind of wide-eyed Wonderland adventures that we had when we were 18 years old, so many decades ago, kids are having them today too. It's still possible, and that's the magic of travel.
Go for it, guys.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick and Isaac Kaplan-Wilner. Our website team includes Andrew Wakeling and Kate Mulhern-Graham, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You'll find more in the radio section of ricksteves.com, and we'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.